The National Broadcasting Company presents Radio City Playhouse, Attraction 11. Radio City Playhouse, Attraction 11, presents The King of the Moon by Joseph Shull. The production is directed by Harry W. Junkin and stars Ian Martin, the brilliant young character actor who delighted Broadway with his performance of Finian in Finian's Rainbow. Here is Radio City Playhouse, Attraction 11, The King of the Moon. Our play starts in a suburban garden in Dublin with a lot of things all growing green, which, considering the ancestry of the man bending over the scallions, is only logical. His name is in keeping, too. It's Michael Ryan.
It is a sad thing to be over 50, never to have seen the world, never to have been the great things you might have been. The passers-by see nothing but a pot-bellied businessman weeding in his garden after supper. A man with the dreams gone out of him.
Michael, must you be pottering about in that garden all evening?
Now, Margaret, who is it was complaining yesterday about the weeds?
No, they could wait another day. I sent the twins off to the movies, and Michael's gone to a dance with that young Roberts girl. And I don't like sitting all alone on the veranda with a dull book.
All right, then come and sit down here and watch me. Oh, you're interfering with me train of thought at the moment.
Michael, are you sure you didn't leave anything at the office today?
Of course I'm sure, and for the third time.
Very well, I merely asked. Now, where is it?
On the customary part of yourself, I presume. I suppose that bench will hold you.
But you've added a few pounds yourself, and you're an old bear.
It's my family responsibilities in contending with a nagging wife.
Oh.
Now, will you get on with that book and leave me to weed and to think?
Is there trouble at the office? Have you been quarreling with Tim again?
I have been quarreling with Tim for 29 years. It's not a thing I give a thought to now.
Oh, Michael, answer me seriously now. Is there nothing you left behind you at the office? Nothing at all?
Woman, I will tear up a fistful of fine new carrots and heave them at you if you ask me that again.
I'm lost in me book. But before you bury your nose in the weeds again, you might take a look at the setting sun. You know, a touch of beauty would do no harm to your warped soul.
I have looked. There's no need for making it a hindrance to my work. I can feel God's beauty warm in the back of my neck and seeping down into my heart. And the voices of the earth come to me through the fingertips.
Well, I've a poet for a husband tonight.
No, not a poet. But a man that might have been many things 28 years ago, who knows?
Who knows what?
Who? Nothing. Get on with your book. Twenty-eight years ago in the spring, and me 25 and 2 years out of the army and into the insurance business with Tim. While the world and its far places and the great things to be done swum round in my head and filled my heart with dreams, I can still remember the sing of the blood in my veins that morning. The morning I go whistling down to the office and pore over my insurance cards and gather the lot of them together and throw them out of the window and go crashing in on Tim as he sat at his desk.
Must you rattle the fillings out of me teeth every time you come in?
I've come to tell you of my decision.
Have you now?
I have. I woke up this morning with it fully formed in me head. I quit.
Oh, is that all?
Now, you're a good friend, Tim, and you were a good officer, and taking me into the business was kindly meant. I appreciate that.
Go on.
But I have been turning things over very seriously in my mind since we had the fight yesterday.
Which one?
The one over the accident policy.
That wasn't much of a fight.
No, but when it was over and I walked out of here and I caught myself feeling the slightest possible of tremors, about how you took it when I called you a pig-headed reactionary.
Oh, that was good of you indeed.
It dawned on me suddenly that I was a mite worried about what you'd think. I was on the verge of becoming careful about what I said. And, oh, Tim boy, beyond that lies the region of terror. The time when I look upon you as the boss, when I'm afraid of being fired, a slave to my paycheck, and no longer a free man. Oh, it's a horrible vista.
Horrible.
But a distant one. I'm free yet. I'm as good a man as you are, and not the one to shrink from saying so.
That I'll grant you.
Though I may have but $150 in the bank where you've 10,000.
Oh, that'll adjust itself in time. Stay with the business long enough, and we'll both have $150 in the bank.
I gather that you're willing to have me go, that you impugn my ability.
I do nothing of the kind. I'm firing you again.
Oh, no, I've had the first word on that score.
And this time you'll stay fired for a couple of months till I'm good and ready to take you back.
That, of course, is ridiculous and a left-handed invitation to stay, which I cannot accept. I have quit definitely and for good.
And what are you going to do?
Tim, how should I know and what should I care what I'm going to do? I'm young and strong with the health bounding in me and the wide world before me. There's gold in Africa and coffee in Brazil and diamonds heaven knows where else. There's great railways to be owned and ships to be sailed and the very kingdoms of the stars but a step away from our science. We may see a man of this earth, a king of the moon, before we die. And am I not as good a man as any? I'll wear no man's collar, Tim, not even yours. Though of all of them, I found it the least abrasive.
Is that so?
Ah, now I'm grateful to you, boy. I'm friends with you, and I hope I always will be. But I'm off to freedom in my own way.
Go ahead. And one of these days, as I've warned you before, I'll be sick of your nonsense.
Nonsense? And you with your bottom glued to a swivel chair and your nose to the grindstone already. Goodbye to you, Tim. So there I am, out on the streets, a free man of my free will and the ways of the world thrown open to me. Ah, the shops are good to look at and the tall buildings and the fine cars, and I'd own them all someday. And I'm striding along with a good free stride and looking back and I forget what was you...
Hurry, where you're going!
And there was me first glimpse of herself. She'd come out of the drugstore wearing the red hat jaunty on her head, and I still say it's the best hat she ever had, and a jar of cold cream in her hand. And now she's sitting on the sidewalk with a red hat over one eye and the cold cream oozing out onto the pavement beside her, and me standing over her, looking sheepish.
You always charge up the street with your eyes in the back of your neck.
Oh, there now. Oh, up you get.
Let me alone.
There you are.
How will you look at my dress?
Oh, now, sure, oh. It was an accident which I shall regret to my dying day, and you exaggerate. I was merely glancing back over my shoulder.
Oh, you clumsy lout.
You know, it's a pretty hat, and maybe it does belong over that eye, but it gives you the suggestion of a skull.
Well,
now, if you were to push it back a little...
Indeed.
There, that's better. Now, turn around, and I'll give you a bit of brushing off on your back.
Your pardon.
Well, very well, do it yourself.
Thank you. And now, if you will indicate the direction in which you're going, I'll move off in the other.
There's another thought which occurs to me.
Well, I haven't the time to hear it.
I'll be delighted to buy you a bucket of cold cream if you'll allow me to pour out my apologies across the table.
What?
I mean to see if maybe a small steak and a double banana split could win a smile of you where I have failed.
That is impudence heaped upon injury. And no matter how I meet strange men, I never accept a first invitation from them. And further apologies should be addressed to Dublin 54298, Miss Margaret Dillon, and the best day is Thursday. Good morning.
So there I am with the lands of the world beckoning and the seas and the ships to take me there, and I chained to the town and the street and the back bedroom at Mrs. Silverstein's for 48 hours, all because it's Tuesday. And Thursday morning, bright and early, I'm rushing for the telephone. There wouldn't be a Miss Margaret Dillon at that place, would there?
Sure, but she's busy with the president.
The president? Thank you very much. Six times it was in 2 hours of a fine spring morning before she answered, and allowed herself to be coaxed to a movie with Douglas Fairbanks climbing over housetops and jumping from cliffs and filling the brain with thoughts of the adventures that might be had. And a fine, full-blooded quarrel we have on the way home. With me telling her of the road fever in me veins, and her thinking it scandalous that I have no job and no ambition, and preaching the cause of the sedentary that end up with automobiles and duodenal ulcers, and generally revealing a disgusting narrowness of viewpoint. And we decide to continue the argument on the following Tuesday, though she saw very little point in it since she'd already said the last word. So for the Tuesday, I decide to try dancing. And we come to a restaurant where there is a little music. And we sit down, and she's wearing the red hat, and her eyes are blue beneath it. And she finds a smile for me, and the chains I felt settled upon me were jingling like silver bracelets. And in spite of my best efforts, it was a pleasant sound. And I couldn't forbear telling her I was glad to see her and thinking of her. And she said she'd been worrying about me and my wild ideas. And then, almost on the waiter's heels, came that great oaf, Tim.
Hello there, Michael. Michael, it's good to see you.
And I'm glad to see you, Tim.
And in such good company.
Yes.
I've been wondering about you and waiting for you to come round again.
I'm still of the same mind as when I left, Tim. Are you looking for someone?
No. No?
Well, perhaps I'll find a table for you then.
It seems a very crowded place tonight.
Yes, it does. Well, Tim, I'll be seeing you around one of these days.
Aren't you going to introduce me to the young lady?
I had not thought of it. However, Miss Dillon, this is Mr. Moran.
Delighted, Miss Dillon.
How do you do, Mr. Moran?
Michael and Miss Dillon, would you take it amiss if I were to join you? Eating alone is a most distasteful business to a sociable man.
As the act of a gentleman and a favor to a friend, will you get the devil out of here?
Would you mind, Miss Dillon?
Not at all, Mr. Moran, not at all.
Not at all, and she looks at him with a great, deep smile she'd never given me. And he plants himself at the table and has the impudence to dance with her, and the evening's ruined except once in a while when I get her away from his endless babble for a dance. And then it's worse.
I think you're rude and stupid, and I cannot see how you've ever kept a friend, judging by the way you treat Mr. Moran. You've not said a civil word to him all evening.
If he'd had the barest scrap of decency, he'd never have butted in on us. And beating your eardrums into this talk about the insurance business. Who wants to hear about insurance?
I do. It's very interesting.
It's not the insurance that's interesting you.
We'll sit down now.
And then we're going home at the end of a lovely evening, still the three of us, and him lying himself black in the face about where he lived so that he could walk with us all the way to her house, and only leaving it at the gate when I kick him in the shin. And well, I knew he'd made a careful note of the address.
You know, Mr. Moran is very nice.
I can only say for him that sold to a glue factory and boiled down, he'd make the world's finest adhesive. The only satisfaction I've got is knowing that he has a 3-mile walk home.
Oh, he hasn't. He said he lives only a little way from here.
He's a liar, among other things.
Well, at least he's a man with ambition. And I'm ashamed of you for leaving your job with him and all the fine chances he offered you.
I'll have fleets of automobiles where he has one and towns where he has houses before I'm finished.
And how are you going to get them?
Oh, Margaret, the ways to success are endless to the man with brains and hands and courage.
And every one of them requires work.
I'm not afraid of work. I look about, see the world and what it has to offer, and shape it to my hands. Will you come dancing on Thursday?
Nope.
Why not?
Because you cannot afford the money until you get yourself work and stop dreaming your way through life.
I am not dreaming my way through life. My plans are definite.
Definite?
That's what they are. I'll wear no man's collar and settle down into the first comfortable rut in which I happen to find myself.
And I'll not waste the time of anyone who'd walk out of a job in such prospects with a fine man like Mr. Moran. Good night, Mr. Ryan.
So there I am, walking home in the moonlight, free of the air again, and taking a savage kick at every stone on the road as I pass. Yeah. And the next morning it's still spring, and the world is as wide as ever, and there are grand opportunities for a young man in Duluth and San Francisco and London and Auckland, and fortunes to be made in India and gold in Africa and the Pampas waving in South America, and all the world to be seen, and I not have to see it. That Tim. 30 years old he is, getting on for middle age and solid in his rut as a mid-course. But it comes to me suddenly that he is 6 feet tall, with curly hair and blue eyes and such. And there is the possibility that a woman might see something in him. And so after a bit of that sort of thinking, I get up from my chair in the garden and walk downtown and go in and knock on his door, with my pride rising in my throat like a wet sponge. And he says, come in, and there he is with his feet on the table and a thumb to his mouth, as though he'd been biting it. Good morning, Tim.
Where did you meet her?
Who?
And what have you been doing to her?
I have no idea of whom you are speaking.
That one. I'm a reasonable man and never too fixed in my viewpoint to change it. Now, I've always been of the opinion that you were a harmless lunatic.
What?
But Miss Dillon seems to have it so firmly fixed in her head that the only worthwhile people in the world are the dreamers. And the men with imagination,
What did you say?
I said that you've thrown a spell over Miss Dillon, which inclines her to believe that you have courage instead of being lazy, and brains instead of the gift of the gab, and she's made a reluctant convert of me. I'm merely growing old before me time by staying here and trying to build up a business. I'm going to leave it.
What?
And see what the world offers in the way of large opportunities and adventure.
But what's going to happen to the business?
To this business? Anything that happens will be an improvement. It can go to blazes.
Oh, and I suppose you'll be bragging to Miss Dillon of your great resolve.
I'll be informing her of it on Thursday night.
So you've been after her already?
You've known her for exactly 1 week. That's a start which can be overtaken.
We'll see about that. Where does Miss Dillon work?
In that office there. But you can't be going in there. That's the president's house.
Aha!
Michael, you cannot come in here. The president...
Ah, hang your old president. I think it only right to tell you that your shameless feminine duplicity has resulted in the wrecking of not one life, but of two.
What?
I cannot go back to the business even if I wanted to, because Tim has now decided to close it up and go off hunting ivory in Africa or seals in Lapland.
Has he indeed? And what have I to do with it?
Everything you belabored to me, you praised to him. And he now thinks I was right where I know I was wrong and is off to do as I am now not going to do.
I have become entangled with two madmen, and the sooner you're both out of my life, the better.
Dine in with him tomorrow evening is no way to get him out of your life.
That's no concern of yours. And you have no cause to be interested in the fact that we'll be dining at the Moresby at 8:15. And now, will you leave me to my work before the president comes in here and throws you out?
The Moresby, 8:15.
Well, good evening to you both.
Good evening, Michael.
And why the devil should you be happening along here at this minute?
The Moresby is a public eating place, and I'm prepared to pay my bill. I am also prepared to join you, if invited.
We're expecting me grandfather, who makes noises with his soup, and his older sister, who is a suffragette. You won't find the company entertaining.
Perhaps if Miss Dillon did not object, I might fill in the time until they arrive.
Oh, sit down, Michael. And wipe those scowls off your faces, both of you.
Thank you, Margaret. Well, I understand that you're off for Tasmania or Baluchistan, Tim.
I am not.
Or was it Greenland, perhaps?
I'm staying right here in this town. I'm remaining in the insurance business. I shall be buried here.
I shall be glad to go to the funeral.
Miss Dillon, would you care to dance?
With pleasure, Mr. Moran.
It wasn't the sort of dancing to worry a man. Tim's face was like Asa Craig, and he held Margaret with the grip that is used for shoving a large chest of drawers from one corner to another. The entire conversation, so far as I could see, consisted of three sarries from Tim. Finally, the dance ended. And there was a solemn, shifty smile in the back of Margaret's eyes when they returned to the table.
I am now going to powder my nose, if you'll both excuse me.
She told you we were going to be here.
Perhaps she didn't.
A man with any decency would not have come trailing after us.
Decency is a strange word in your mouth.
I've been hearing more about your singular virtues. I'm sick of the sound of your name.
Indeed.
I find it incredible, and only a step this side of madness. But there's no question about it. She prefers you to me.
She doesn't.
She does. She told me so.
She didn't.
Well, in so many words.
And so she came back. And the clouds were billowing under her feet, and the band was playing heavenly hymns about her. And there were stars in her hair, and a shower of rose petals falling about her from the clouds. And I stood up at the table and held out my arms as wide as was seemly, and greeted her with a brilliant smile that must have won her. And she said,
"Sit down and stop making a spectacle of yourself,
Margaret." Oh, now, Margaret, would you dance with me?
Yes.
Darling.
Oh, stop it.
Oh, my darling, I'll shower you with diamonds. I'll ransack the kingdoms of the moon for you. 40 footmen each in a Rolls Royce will go before you and behind you when you travel.
I've no ambition to become the world's greatest traffic problem. Have you gone mad?
I think so. Oh, I knew your heart was the dreamer's heart, too.
Oh, did you indeed?
Tim's going to stay in the business and let him.
And so are you.
What?
He's going to ask you tonight. He's going to take you outside right after this dance. But, and Michael, if you refuse, I'll never speak to you again.
Margaret,
after all the trouble I've been through to put in a word for you.
Put in a word for you? With Tim? I never needed a word put in for me with Tim.
Well, you've had it. Now remember, after this dance.
And so the dance ended and we came back to the table and Tim and I looked each other very hard in the eye and then we looked at Margaret and then he got up and we turned together and walked away without a word. And out of the corner of my eye I saw Margaret look around her and hold her handkerchief just a bit above the table and then let it drop. Meanwhile, Tim and I stood in the lounge and looked at each other hard again and shook hands very solemnly.
We've been hornswoggled by the world's most designing female.
For our own good. Oh,
very well, for our own good. But I'm sad at the thought of what your married life's going to be like, and I wish you every happiness.
I'm not saying, mind, that just because I'm soon to be a married man, I'll stay in the insurance business. I'm wearing no chains yet.
The clank of them's deafening me this minute. Ah, but it's a pleasant sound at that. And one to make an old bachelor envious.
Ah, now cheer up, Tim. Boy, there's other women in the world.
None like her. And I wish I'd never set eyes on her. Come on back.
And we start back, and we get in sight of our own table, and our heads snap up, and our eyes goggle, because without a drop to cause it, we're seeing double. There are two Margarets at the table. Or rather, there's my Margaret and another that might have been born a year or two before her as the Margaret. And our feet bring us to the table without our having anything to do with it, and Margaret favors us with a sweet, wide-eyed smile. And I suddenly remember the sight of that dropped handkerchief.
But don't gape so, you two. It's only my sisters. Moira, this is Michael Ryan, and this is Timothy Moran.
How do you do?
Do take your chair again, Mr. Moran. I only sat down for a moment. I'm at another table.
With whom?
Two of my girlfriends. We thought you'd have dinner here and listen to the music. Coincidence, isn't it?
It is, indeed.
Do take your chair, Mr. Moran.
I'd not think of it.
Oh, but I must be getting back to my friends anyway.
Nonsense! Two girls alone are no more miserable than three. You'll stay with me.
I'd not think of intruding on you.
It'd be far from an intrusion, and we insist. Be the high heaven and the light of the stars. I'll stand no more nonsense from the Dillon family. Sit down, woman, or I'll pick you up in my arms and sit you down myself.
Very well, if you're determined to use force.
That was 28 years ago, and it was the last show of force either of us ever made. Ah, well. Well, past the radishes.
Oh, well, if you're finished at last, we'll go in.
A fine, clean garden, is it not?
Michael Ryan, I'll ask you once more and for the last time, did you leave?
No, and no, and no, I did not forget anything at the office.
Well, then I wish I'd not baked a cake and got in sherry and asked Tim and Moira to come over tonight.
Oh, you do?
I'll be ashamed for the first time in my life, and I'm hurt, too.
Are you now?
You don't even ask me why.
Well, I was thinking of something else. Whatever became of that red hat?
What red hat?
The one you were wearing when I first bumped into you outside the drugstore.
That was a blue hat. They gave it to the cleaning woman 15 years ago.
You'd never had another as good. And it was red.
It was blue.
Do you not think I can remember what you were wearing the day I met you?
Well, with such a memory, it's a pity you can't remember the day you married me.
If you think I've been unable to perceive the drift of your hints and questionings all the evening, you still underestimate me after 20 and more years. If you'll go to my coat and put your hand in the right-hand pocket, you'll find your look.
Oh, my
God. And I did not, as I have been maintaining with entire truthfulness, forget it at the office.
Ah, you darling old blackguard. Come on in, Michael. Tis little weeding you can do by the light of the moon.
The moon. And I once wanted to be king of it. Ah, well, there's been no one else set foot on the moon either. Maybe it'll be Michael Jr. who plants the name of Ryan there.
That was King of the Moon, as written by Joseph Shule. The production was directed by Harry W. Duncan. Ian Martin, recently starred in Finian's Rainbow, was heard as Michael. Andre Wallace was Margaret. Other players were Roy Irving and Grace Keddy. The music was composed and conducted by Dr. Roy Shield. Radio City Playhouse is supervised for the National Broadcasting Company by Richard P. McDonough. Beginning next week, Radio City Playhouse will be heard on Saturdays at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time over most of these NBC stations. Our first offering in this new time is Mother by Stanley Robert Mednick, the psychological study of a strange and sadly confused woman. Be with us then next Saturday, September the 11th at 8 o'clock for Mother, Attraction 12 on Radio City Playhouse. Robert Warren speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.